Bel Air pastor who was thought to be in a conference in Bermuda. They asked me how soon I could come to Washington. I told them I could be ready almost immediately. I got a private plane to National Airport, where I was met by a White House car. When I saw Nancy the next day, she was calm, but I could sense the anxiety and concern she felt by the tears in her eyes and the extra hug she gave me. I was reminded again of the great love they had for each other, and I knew he depended on her greatly, not only for emotional support and encouragement, but also for advice. I had read that the Hinckleys, whose son shot the president, were Christians. I called them in Colorado and assured them of my prayers too, because I knew their hearts must have been breaking. When stories later came out about Nancy's having consulted an astrologer on family and national issues after the assassination attempt, I was amazed. I had not ever seen her as a gullible or experimental person in her spiritual understanding, and could not help but feel it was a momentary lapse caused by anxiety and stress. I called her on the phone at the time and talked frankly to her about it. "Nancy, surely you didn't really look into astrology, especially for something as important as the dates when the cabinet should meet." "Billy," she responded, "what you have read is only part of the story. It is 90% untrue, but there is possibly 10% truth in it," she admitted. I urged her to seek her guidance from the Lord instead. In the 40 years since I first met Ronald Reagan, he has taught me a lot, not in words so much as by example. His optimistic spirit was contagious. I have often been a worrier, if biting my fingernails is any sign, even though I know, underneath it all, that God is in charge. After he left office, we stayed close to Ron and Nancy. His life in retirement was packed with travels and engagements and a multitude of responsibilities. I have seen them in California from time to time, and several times I've attended the Bel Air Presbyterian Church with them. I also saw him at the funeral for Richard Nixon on April 27, 1994, where he joined the other presidents and President Clinton in paying tribute. I could tell, however, that some of the old sparkle had gone, and I was very saddened when they announced some months later that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. At the same time, their openness and courage in the face of this debilitating illness have been an inspiration to us all. While he was president, Ronald Reagan bestowed on me one of the highest honors I could ever imagine. On February 23, 1983, he presented me with a Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor our government gives to an American for service to the nation. I felt unworthy of the honor, and still do. But whatever else it means, it will always remind me of the generosity and friendship of a remarkable man and a warm and enduring personal friend, Ronald Wilson Reagan. Very few people, including me, ever imagined that communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union would collapse almost overnight. For years, I had been saying privately that Soviet-style communism was both unworkable and unnatural and couldn't last indefinitely. But as we approached the mid-1980s, no one could have predicted that in half a dozen years the Berlin Wall would be torn down and the Soviet Union disbanded. 4 years after our 1984 tour, we returned to the Soviet Union, this time to join with others in the celebration of the 1,000th anniversary of the Russian Orthodox Church in June 1988. Although the schedule was crammed with services and other meetings, the heady climate of glasnost and perestroika under General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev added new dimensions to everything. In some ways, I wasn't surprised at the changes Mr. Gorbachev was making. A few months before, while he was in Washington for a state visit, I met him and was impressed by his charm and his new perspectives. As soon as I entered the Russian embassy for a small reception in December 1987, former Soviet Ambassador Dobrynin made a beeline for me, wanting to make sure that I met Gorbachev. "Oh, yes, I have heard about you," he said as he greeted me warmly. "You have been in our country, and when you come back, we will welcome you again." The 1988 celebration in Russia commemorated the time 1,000 years ago when Prince Vladimir of Rus, founder of modern Russia, embraced Christianity and promptly ordered all his subjects to be baptized in the Dnieper River near Kiev. From then until the Bolshevik Revolution, Orthodox Christianity was the official Russian state religion. Now the Russian Orthodox Church was celebrating its millennium. I gladly accepted the Orthodox invitation to participate in their celebration. All who professed to believe and follow Christ deserved whatever encouragement in the faith we could give. I did not accept without a few misgivings, though. For one thing, some Ukrainians in America were sensitive about developments in their homeland and did not look too favorably on my projected visit to Kiev, Orthodoxy's birthplace. Furthermore, my more conservative American colleagues were still troubled by what struck them as compromises I was making with a non-democratic government and a non-evangelical religious body. That a religious anniversary could be celebrated at all in the Soviet Union was certainly a sign of the changing times. During his visits to Moscow to prepare for our trip, Alex Horosty had perceived a sharp split within the Soviet government over whether the 1,000th anniversary should be acknowledged or totally ignored. At the very most, it was argued by some, it should be downplayed. I'm convinced that the final decision to give public prominence to the occasion did much to foster later changes in that society. At the churches where I spoke, old restrictions were overthrown. Loudspeakers were set up outside to carry the message to people who could not get in, reaching even the people a block or more away. Far from restricting religious observance to church facilities, the government gave permission to hold 2 main events of the millennial commemoration at the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow and the Shevchenko Theater in Kiev. At the Bolshoi, Mrs. Raisa Gorbachev sat in the front row, just 4 seats away from the pulpit while I gave my address. And for the first time, a religious event, the millennial celebration, was featured extensively in the Soviet media. In recognition of our presence, the Kremlin arranged for us to be received by the longtime foreign minister, Andrei Gromyko. He spoke to us in the Presidium Council Chamber about the impact of new policies on church life. At an appropriate moment afterward, we were able to distribute the Russian Bibles we had brought along for high-level officials, each handsomely bound in leather and personalized with the name of a Politburo member embossed on the cover. Both Mr. Gromyko and Mr. Gorbachev were among those who were given personal copies. The largest audience I spoke to in the Soviet Union was at the Cathedral of St. Vladimir in Kiev, where 15,000 people not only packed the huge building, but also spilled out into the surrounding courtyard. It received coverage on national radio and television, and in the 2 official papers, Pravda and Izvestia. A fascinating sidelight did not make the newspapers. In the course of preparing for the service, church officials realized that the electrical system in the cathedral wouldn't be up to the demands of the television lights and the special sound system that were to be installed, both inside and outside the building. At the request of the local church officials, therefore, and almost certainly with the permission of political and military authorities in Moscow, the Red Army trucked in one of its large portable generators and parked it outside the church. As the congregation approached the cathedral that evening, their eyes must have popped at the sight of military vehicles around the cathedral and at the friendliness of the military personnel. If the Christians were amazed, so were the Red Army technicians, I suspect. This sort of church-state cooperation surely was a first in the Soviet Union. In Kiev, I spoke also at the little Baptist church that normally held several hundred. A few thousand were packed inside and around the whole neighborhood outside the church. We could hardly get our car through the crowd to the building. Later, about 15 of us met with members of the Politburo of the Ukraine. The Prime Minister, a woman, sat with us and answered our questions. She said immediately, for the benefit of her colleagues and the tape recorders, I suspect, that she was a communist and an atheist. Afterward, though, she took me aside and conversed in excellent English. "You know, Dr. Graham, I always go on a certain day to see my mother, who lives beyond the Baptist church where you preached. I am always amazed as I pass that church that it is so filled with young people." She paused. "I have my driver stop the car sometimes just so I can watch them." She paused again. "There's something about the Baptists that attracts young people." In July 1991, I was in Moscow again. In the intervening 3 years since the 1988 millennial celebration, a virtual revolution had taken place in the Soviet Union. Old ideas and old restrictions were swept aside in every area of life, including religion. Things that would have been impossible, even inconceivable, a few years before, were now a reality. This time I presided at an evangelism training conference that the BGEA sponsored. The Orthodox Church did not participate officially, although it was Patriarch Piman, recently deceased, who, in a way, had invited me to conduct evangelism training in the Soviet Union. When he was lying ill at Zagorsk Monastery in 1988, he asked me to pray with him. I sat by his side for a long time and held his hand. He told me again, as he had on an earlier visit, that he wanted his priest to learn how to preach evangelistic sermons. I prayed for him as my brother in Christ. If ever there was a miracle, the Moscow School of Evangelism was it. More than 4,900 Soviet Protestant pastors, lay preachers, and teachers gathered to hear a number of speakers from various countries on evangelism. Among them were my son Franklin and my daughter, Anne Graham Lotz. We convened in an atmosphere of optimism that was almost intoxicating. Delegates went into the streets and onto buses, boldly witnessing for Christ, open Bibles in their hands, an amazing sign of the changes taking place. And there were other signs of growing religious freedom throughout the country. The importation of Bibles and other Christian literature was rising almost to a flood level, and Soviet children were again allowed to attend churches and to receive religious instruction. The last day of the conference, General Secretary Gorbachev received me in his office for about 40 minutes, the first time I had been with him in that setting. Our two-minute appearance together before the television cameras was shown throughout the USSR in all 11 time zones on a top-rated news show. The subject of spiritual values in society was uppermost in our conversation. On July 13th, the day before I left for America, I was unexpectedly invited to meet with Boris Yeltsin at his office in the Kremlin. We talked together for an hour. I got the impression that he was even more interested in the religious side of things than Mr. Gorbachev. He did not hesitate to tell me that he no longer was a communist. I thought he sounded pleased when he volunteered that his three granddaughters all wore crosses now. Only a few weeks after we left the Soviet Union, old-line communist leaders attempted a coup. For several days, the fate of democratic reform in the USSR hung in the balance. I could not help but thank God for the opening He had given us for training so many during the School of Evangelism. What might they be facing in the future? As an anxious world watched, the coup collapsed on August 21st with a minimum of bloodshed. 3 days later, General Secretary Gorbachev, at Yeltsin's insistence, disbanded the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, effectively ending not only Gorbachev's own leadership, but also 7 decades of Marxist rule. A new day had truly dawned, not only politically, but religiously, in what had once been the world's strongest bastion of atheism. And with those new changes, new opportunities for the proclamation of the gospel opened up. Almost immediately after the failed coup, we were approached by Russian church leaders about the possibility of holding a full-scale evangelistic crusade in Moscow and perhaps several other cities. Sensing God had opened the door, we accepted the invitation for October 1992. For logistical reasons, we felt it best to concentrate on Moscow. Difficulties in transportation and communication, we realized, would make it almost impossible to undertake the massive organization required for such an extensive effort in more than one city. Although advertising in post-communist Russia was still in its infancy, we managed to obtain a number of prominent billboards. Ours was the largest non-government advertising campaign to date. Leaflets describing the meetings and giving a brief gospel message, 3.2 million of them, were delivered to every Moscow mailbox. 30 training centers were organized for weekly Bible studies following the crusade, supplementing the work of the small number of churches in Moscow. Every night, the covered Olympic Stadium was packed beyond capacity. Overflow crowds in the thousands stood outside in the chilly late October air to watch over a large screen television. At the final meeting, Sunday afternoon, an estimated 50,000 people jammed the stadium. An additional 20,000 watched outside. I worked diligently in my sermons to make the gospel as clear and as simple as possible. Most of those listening, I knew, had virtually no knowledge of the Bible or of Christ. And yet I also tried to set forth as forcefully as possible Christ's call to leave the past behind and to become His followers. 7,000 people signed up for the choir, and at every service we had special music by various Russian Christian musical groups. On Saturday night, the soaring voices of a magnificent men's chorus resounded throughout the huge overflowing stadium, triumphantly echoing the familiar strains of one of America's best-loved hymns of faith, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. After the final service, I stood in my hotel room overlooking the Kremlin. I couldn't help but think back to the prayer I had uttered in Lenin Stadium when Grady Wilson and I first visited Moscow as tourists in 1959. Asking God for an opportunity to preach the gospel in that nation. Over 30 years had passed, and Grady was now in heaven. But now, beyond doubt, God had answered our prayer. The Bel Air pastor, who was thought to be